Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor and producer Elijah Wood. I was really curious to sit down with Elijah because there were so many things that fascinated me about his career. First, how does a kid from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, become one of film's most acclaimed child actors at age 12 without imploding? And after you top that off at 18 with one of the most successful film franchises in history, where do you go from there? Well, Elijah went where few actors in his position would, exactly where he wanted to. If his post-Lord of the Rings choices were based on career advancement, he might be richer or even more famous. He might also be less creatively free and fulfilled, and he'd likely never have done Wilfred, Grand Piano, or his latest film, entitled I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Like Wood, none of those weird and wonderful stories go where we expect. Talking to him, it's obvious he's enjoying the ride. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Elijah.
Hello, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Dude, I'm so excited.
We met a long time ago, and I've always been a fan of you and just the way you've picked projects for your career. Like, you haven't let your career pick you, and you haven't made choices, like, at least from this perspective, where it seems like you let fear dictate what you're going to do or how you're going to run your career. It seems like you're a guy that's very interested in having experimental new experiences.
I think it's not a given thing. That's so astute.
Well, I think
that's very much how I feel about my life and career. I look at it very much in that way. It's galvanized for me even more the older I've gotten, this notion of I just want to work on things that I care about and that I think are interesting and that can challenge me. And I'm always just chasing that. So I'm looking for new experiences. I'm largely more interested in a filmmaker and his or her vision than I am specifically about a role or a kind of role. I just want to be a part of facilitating interesting work. I never really think strategically, for better or worse. You know, I think if I'd thought strategically, I might be in a different place. But I'm so happy being where I am in the sense that I've been able to carve out a really weird, kind of interesting path that allows me freedom to explore and do different things that perhaps I wouldn't have had if I'd taken a more strategic route. And I do the work because I'm interested in the work. I love filmmaking. I love the process. I love the collaborative artistic process, a group of people gathering together towards a shared vision. That's what I get so much out of that. That's what I do this for.
You know, I'm curious about something because, you know, you've been an actor your entire life and you've been in the business long enough to see everything, the way people conduct themselves and their careers. Mm-hmm. And you've had so many jobs already at a relatively young age. And I wonder if there are still situations where you can still scare yourself, or you still getting nervous, or if this is easy for you now?
No.
Do you still get nervous?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I think every job, in some ways, there's enough time between a job, and that can be anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. Even if it's 3 weeks, it's a new experience. So moving from one job to another, it's like starting over again for me. And I get that first day of school feeling every time.
It's not all blasé to you.
Not at all. I still get the feeling occasionally that I could be fired, that I'm expendable.
Really?
I don't take any of it for granted. I think it would be a real shame to get blasé about the process or any aspect of what it is that I do or that you do. I think that, to a certain degree, is a sense of death. If you're not afraid on some level, then you're not pushing yourself.
Right. You know, I saw this film two nights ago, Grand Piano, that you were in.
Oh, no way.
And it blew me away. And for people who haven't seen this film, it's De Palma-esque in its tension and in its, I don't want to say surrealness, but in there's a life heightened. The film is saying a larger thing about, in this case, anxiety and fear. Mm-hmm. And in it, you play a pianist that had some horrible experience 5 years previous to the film starting where he bombed spectacularly on stage. And
The film starts on the day your character is making his comeback to play this very difficult piece of music.
Yeah.
And as he starts the concert, he finds out there's an assassin in the audience who's going to shoot him and kill him if he plays a wrong note. And, I wonder if when you saw that script for the first time, if you saw it as a metaphor or if you saw it as a straight-up thriller.
I think both, but very much a metaphor.
Yeah.
I mean, it is that thing of it actualizes the notion of fear and anxiety, and it puts it into the context of a man holding this person hostage. So no, it's very metaphorical, but the thing I connected to was sort of the audacity of the script. I mean, it's an incredibly ambitious notion to like set this movie. It's primarily in real time.
Takes place in one night.
It takes place in one night during this performance, and it's largely a pianist at his piano trying to get through the pieces of music that he's playing and also stay alive. I just love the audacity of it. It was actually written by Damien Chazelle, who wrote and directed Whiplash and La La Land.
Right.
And it has elements of Chazelle in there. Like, it's the love of music, the intensity of practice and the craft and honing that skill over X amount of time, which seems to be something that really comes up a lot in his films.
Yeah.
And also his love of cinema. There's a great deal within the context of the script itself that was very much an ode to sort of Hitchcock and De Palma. These were massive references. And Eugenio, who's a Spanish director, took all of that and made something so grand and cinematic.
Well, what's fascinating about it when you describe it as a guy trying to get through a night on stage without dying, isn't that exactly the feeling that an actor has at times in his career, is to just get through a performance and feeling like you're going to die if you get it wrong? And it's a fascinating look at taking a fear that we don't really name that's inside us, that, you know, what would happen if I screwed up? And giving it
real world heights or...
Yeah. You know, because I would think for an actor the challenge would be, you know, you're pretty much grounded to the piano bench and having a conversation with someone who's just in your earpiece. So how do you make it, not to make a bad pun, but how do you not make that performance one note?
Totally, yeah. It was very scary, the notion of that very thing, of just being afraid the whole time and having that not have peaks and valleys or dynamics.
Right, because once we see that as an audience, we're like, okay, he's afraid. I'd be afraid too.
Totally. And he's essentially afraid immediately as soon as he sits down and realizes what's actually happening and that it's not a joke. I had both the challenge of giving the character somewhere to go and there being dynamics within the context of what his situation was, but also playing the piano and simultaneously listening to John Cusack's pre-recorded dialogue in my ear and speaking back. I had this crazy sort of... multiple things happening at once occasionally, which I'd never experienced. And I'd played piano when I was younger. I'd taken lessons, and like many people who don't stick with it, I quit because I didn't want to practice anymore.
Sounds like my kids.
And I still regret it. Don't quit. But I'd had essentially the fundamentals of the instrument, but the character that I played is a genius piano player who could play anything, and he's sort of this prodigy, so the pieces of music that I had were far beyond my capability. But I took lessons prior to going to Spain to shoot the film and continued rehearsing there. And man, like, so many discouraging days where I thought, I don't know if I can do this.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's really hard.
The way it was shot, it's clear there's not a double in there doing anything. It's you and you know, that's got to be hard, and I would think that also the noise you're making on the piano isn't the noise that...
No, but they muted the piano.
Oh, they did?
They did.
Interesting.
Which initially was very strange, because to a certain degree, I mean, all of the practice that I'd done was with a piano, so hearing where I was, you use it as a reference. Like, okay, at least I know where I'm at. When you don't have an audio reference to what you're playing, it was initially kind of off-putting, but it was actually a lifesaver, because I think it would have been more distracting had the piano actually worked and I was making a racket.
Well, the interesting thing about the construct of the film is it's sort of like almost poking fun at the heights we can take art and drama.
We take it.
How seriously we take it. Was there a key or a personal experience to get yourself in that place where we as an audience can believe that kind of fear?
My entry in, it was a character I couldn't really relate to. There's a sort of a stuffy haughtiness to him, I think, at least from his past, that comes with being a master of something. I couldn't really relate to that. What I could relate to was the scenario that he was in. I think we can all relate to that. Not to that degree. We've certainly never faced death in any kind of artistic expression, but we've certainly been in situations that have felt dire and felt terrifying.
What comes to mind for you is one for you?
Probably the both times I've done anything on stage, it's terrifying to me. And it's not my background. A lot of people start in stage. And
right, you started on film.
And I started on film. So my experience was there's a charitable organization that does an event around the world. They do it. It's called the 24-Hour Plays. And they get a group of actors and writers and directors together. And they all meet one evening. Everyone brings a prop and a piece of clothing. And they introduce themselves, and perhaps they'll say something that they have always wanted to do on stage, or I have this ability or that ability. The writers then take all of that information and craft, I think it's 10 5-minute plays. And then everyone meets at the theater that morning. You're then handed a script, given a role, your director, your fellow castmates, and then you go off and rehearse all day.
Sounds like a reality show.
It does, kind of. And then that evening, on a Broadway stage, you perform in front of a full packed house.
Really?
That was my very first experience doing something on stage. And it was...
Oh, my God.
What was crazy about it is, you know, typically if you're doing a play, you've got months of rehearsal. So you've got so much time to get the material in your skin and live with it and breathe it. This is 24 hours, so even the seasoned veterans of theater are terrified.
I'm sure.
I did it twice in a row, so it was both completely exhilarating and the most fucking scary thing I've ever done. And I also did stand-up once.
Oh, you did?
That actually might be the most scared I've ever been. So I did a short film called Set Up Punch that a friend of mine wrote about his own experience doing stand-up, where he proposed to his then-girlfriend on stage and was refused on stage. She left the building, and then he ultimately spent the next 10 minutes trying to gain the audience back and make them laugh again.
Oh,
and the whole thing was actually a ruse. It was just sort of like an Andy Kaufman.
So she was in on it.
She was in on it.
Okay.
So he wrote a short film about it, and he asked if I would play the role. And I'd heard the story so many times, and I was thrilled at the notion of playing the role, but then immediately terrified because I thought, well, I'm gonna have to have an experience doing it for real.
Before filming.
Yeah, before we shoot it, I knew that there was no way for me, in any kind of genuine sense, to play a stand-up comedian if I hadn't had some experience knowing what it felt to be in that position. And so for about 2 or 3 months prior to us shooting it, myself and David, the director, would discuss the notion of doing it.
Right.
And I kind of just kept pushing it off because it was a terrifying idea. And then finally, I think we were shooting on the Monday and it was like the Friday before.
You're like, I better do my prep.
So he was like, I'm booking you a slot. And I was like, okay. So he booked me a slot at the, I think it was the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
And so I had a 7:30 p.m. slot that night.
Unbilled, right? No one knows it's going to be you.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I went to his house. We wrote the material, because I think in his head, he had imagined that I would take the jokes from the script. But that sort of terrified me more, in the sense that I would be too worried about remembering somebody else's jokes.
Right.
Rather than writing something myself that it's coming from something internal, and I can always fall back on that.
So how do you do that? How do you write a set of material about yourself in one day?
So we did it over the course of a night. It was about probably 3 hours of work, and I had a bunch of ideas, and we kind of crafted it together into something that resembled a 5-minute set.
Do you remember your opening?
Yeah. I really have to pee.
That was your opening?
That was my opening.
Because people sometimes have to pee in here. So I didn't know if that was, but that was your opening.
That was my opening. But I'll never forget it. We got to the comedy club and there were a series of comedians before me. The stage manager came over and he said, you're you know, number five in line. I'll come over and get you when the comedian before you is on stage or just goes on stage. And I had that feeling of, it felt like I was about to jump out of a plane.
Yeah,
like I had, there was nothing I could do.
And you're watching four seasoned veterans in front of you.
Yeah.
Now, are you questioning all your material as you watch them?
That, and also trying to remember everything that I'd come up with, you know? So I would run those down in my head of, like, what the beats were so I could remember my set. Then I'll never forget, the comedian before me gets up on the stage. I get taken to the side of the stage, and there's that moment of, like, this is it. I now actually can't back out, and I just have to do this. Oh man, butterflies and electricity coursing through my veins. And guy leaves the stage, I get called up onto stage, and I took a breath, and that was what saved me, I think, is instead of barreling through,
which
I think oftentimes is the instinct when you're terrified about something, you just want to get through it.
Right.
And I looked at everyone, took a breath, and said what I said, I have to pee. And that immediately got a laugh. And from there on out, I was able to just let it, like, all the material flowed. It all happened. I didn't kind of forget anything. I got everything out in the way that I wanted to. And the 5 minutes were up, and that was it.
Oh, my God.
And it was a great lesson. You know, easily the scariest thing I've ever done. So outside of my comfort zone. Because there's plenty of times within the context of working as an actor, which is a familiar place, that I'm scared and nervous and anxious. But this was something that was so outside of anything I've ever done before. I had no intentions of ever doing it in my life. I don't even know that I'm that funny. Certainly not a stand-up. And that was exhilarating to have done it. Even if I bombed in a way, I think I would have had the same feeling, which was, at that moment, what I thought I was capable of doing got pushed.
Right.
So your boundaries expanded. That boundary expanded that night. And I now know, at that moment, I thought, well, I can do this, and I never knew I could do that.
It's funny how you had no desire to be a stand-up and no desire to switch careers and start doing
right.
this. And yet, it's still impossible to just go up there and not care, right? It's just
right.
impossible.
Like, of course
because,
it is.
And I would think, you being who you are, there's that extra level of, oh,
this guy?
This guy.
Yeah.
You know?
This actor, he's going to be a stand-up now. He's going to make us laugh. Sure.
I bet you also found that there's an intrinsic, instinctual level of timing that you have from your other career that helped you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, parts of your experience as an actor that translate to standing in front of a stage and, or standing on a stage and being, you know, comfortable being in your own body, right?
Yeah. If I'd had no prior experience playing a character or working as an actor in front of people, I think it would have been a very different experience.
Right.
I don't know that I would have had the wherewithal to take my time.
To have rhythm.
Have rhythm, to hear the laughter, take the time to step back in, know when to... That's true. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Because it felt in so many ways so foreign to me. But I suppose there are elements of being an actor that would have helped in that scenario. But that still is the most terrifying thing to me, whether it's having had that experience or any kind of public speaking.
Is that still terrifying?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't love being in front of a lot of people and having to make a speech or, oof.
When you start a new project, obviously, you're doing a ton of work that nobody ever sees. The director doesn't see it. The audience obviously doesn't see it.
Yeah.
It's sort of your work to get yourself in a place where you're standing on the side of that stage and you're ready to step on and you've prepared as much as you can, right?
Sure.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, if you've ever gotten to a situation where you've prepared and then you step into that set or you step into a meeting with the director and you find out there's something that takes you out of your comfort zone or you find out you're not on the same page with the director or...
I mean, a lot of those conversations also happen before production started. You know, hopefully one has been hired by someone after a certain amount of conversation where you get a sense of synergy in regards to the shared vision or what the character is supposed to be. There have definitely been more comfortable working environments than others.
Sure, sure.
But for the most part, I've always felt like a certain amount of synergy with what the director wanted and a good working environment. But it's different every time.
Yeah.
You know, directors have different methods. There's just different energies. That's also what it's about. I mean, beyond speaking to a specific way of directing or a specific method, it's also just humans connecting or not connecting. You know, do you know what I mean? It's energy and vibes, just the way that we are with the people that we meet in our lives, that we have a sense of who they are and that we're going to connect with them, and people that we definitely feel like we wouldn't connect with. It's also about that, too. And an environment that is created by those people, and that then sort of expounds to everybody else working within the context of that environment.
You growing up in the business and starting when you were so young, mm-hmm. you never had an opportunity to go study Meisner and see if that's your right. your bag, or to study, you know, different actors and different approaches to theater, to method or whatever.
Not at that age anyway.
Not yeah. at that age. And that's fascinating, like how your process developed instinctually. Mm. You know, like Picasso said, it took me 4 years to learn to paint like Raphael, but it took me a lifetime to learn to paint like a child.
Right.
But did you ever think about your process when you were a kid?
No. Not as a kid.
Yeah, like what
Not
was...
Not as a kid. It was the simplest thing as a kid.
And
theoretically, it was very simple. What I was doing, what the job was very simple. It was playing another character, embodying a person, and trying to imbue that person with as much of an understanding of who that person is and as much of reality as possible to make that character come to life in a way that doesn't seem like it's false. It's funny thinking about it now, because obviously it's all reflection, but I did understand it. There was something innate of just connecting to the playfulness of I'm playing a character. The skill was over time, you know, the understanding of it, the depth of it, the mixing with one's own life experience, that just came through experiences. You know, the beautiful thing about being pre-13 or 14 is you're not self-aware.
Right.
So that was kind of the wonderful thing about from 8 to 13, the experiences that I had as an actor were really formative and growth experiences, but they weren't marred by anxiety. How do I look? How am I perceived? That all comes with being a teenager. So I didn't really get nervous then. I wasn't really self-aware. I just had a sort of pure love of what it was that I was doing and all these really interesting, fun experiences that I was having. But I definitely remember the switch. I remember being, I think it was around 12 or 13, and suddenly very aware. And with that came anxiety and nervousness and, you know, distrust of what I was doing and not being sure. I think all of those things are healthy and ultimately pushed me, but I definitely remember that switch. It was so interesting to me of like suddenly, why is this stressing me out now?
Right.
Why? And I think it was, I was working on a film called Forever Young, which Mel Gibson was yep. the lead in the film, and Mel Gibson is frozen with a sort of experimental cryogenic freezing technology in the 1960s.
As one did.
Or 50s, then. I think. Yeah, exactly. In the film, my character is in love with this girl, and he sort of gets this advice from Mel's character to just sing to her, you know? And he takes it literally rather than probably the figurative intention of just let out your feelings. And there was a scene in the film where I had to climb a tree and sing You Are My Sunshine to this girl. And I was terrified. And I was very self-aware of like kind of embarrassed of singing out loud in a soundstage filled with people and all these things that I'd kind of never felt before, where I could kind of be unself-aware at 8, 9, 10, 11 of just sort of playing. Suddenly I was anxious and nervous.
Well, and it's a growing girl, up. And
there's all those things.
Yeah. God, of course. It's so funny to have all these experiences that you had. I mean, I had those experiences, but I'm in high school
right.
or I'm in junior high
right.
and I want to ask a girl to a dance or something, but
sure.
you're doing it, you know, in a, like, that's the crazy thing, you know, is that you came up as an artist working in a creative field, but mm-hmm. you're also a kid working in an adult world.
Sure.
And I think that it must have taken a lot to process, you know?
I think because it started from a relatively young age, so I was 8 when I started, and it was relatively simple and kind of innocuous initially. It was commercials. And
right.
I think my mom thought it would be fun for me to do commercials, and that's kind of all she ever thought I would do, and I was interested in it, but not in any kind of grand way. I hadn't seen a lot of films and thought, I didn't have that sort of epiphanous moment.
Well, you were too young
at 5
to
years
have
of
an
age.
Epiphanous moment.
Yeah, I just didn't have that thing. I certainly loved movies, but I didn't see a film and go, that's what I want to do. But I loved people and I loved new experiences, and the notion of it was fun and exciting. So it started really simply.
Because you lived in Iowa and you moved out to LA.
Right.
Which, that's a big deal too, because your family moved away to see if you could do this, right?
Kind of, yeah. So it was twofold. I think my mom was looking for us to sort of expand our horizons and have, try life somewhere else. You know, and also my brother, who's 7 years older than me, was doing drama and musicals and things in school, so he was interested as well. So we kind of, my mom, my brother, and I, with my dad and my sister back in Iowa, came out to Los Angeles to just see if it would work. And I think we rented a place at the Oakwood Apartments, very famous.
What,
apartment
that place
complex.
Must have the best marketing.
Can you imagine
the entire
stories?
Country? Everyone ends up there.
I know. Nirvana lived in the Oakwood Apartments when they were making Nevermind.
I don't know if I knew that. That's
yeah.
crazy.
So we move out here, but not with a sense of permanence. Like, it was something we'd try and see how it goes. And within the first 6 weeks, I got my first job, and I think my brother started to work, and it became obvious that there was something to pursue.
Your mom was sort of a free spirit, right? Like, what the hell? We'll just move out here.
Just
like,
to see.
That's,
yeah,
that's
and
pretty
then
bold.
Once, it is bold. It is bold. But I think she also really believed in us and wanted to sort of support our interests. And again, I also think she was really interested in providing a new landscape for the family and new experiences. Honestly, my mother would have just as soon taken me out of it if I didn't behave properly.
Oh, is that true?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, I was instilled with so much humility.
Really?
I mean, I wouldn't be the person that I am or where I am in my life if it weren't for my mom. And I think that's the beginnings of everything, is a strong base and a strong
yeah.
sense of identity outside of this thing that I'm in or we're in. Because the industry, if you start to become recognizable at any age, it can do funny things to people.
Yeah, especially
you know,
kid.
As we're all aware of, yeah. And, you know, oftentimes in those scenarios, one defines themselves by the perception or the work that it is that they're doing, rather than a sense of who they are outside of that. And my mom worked really hard to instill us with a sense of normalcy and a life outside of this work that was taking me to different parts of the country and the world, that kind of provided the foundation of me as a human.
Were you ever at a place where you just wanted to quit and be a normal kid? And
I had moments like that.
You did?
Early teens. Because it wasn't until then that I started to recognize that, or it became impactful, that I wasn't going to a regular school or that I didn't have a lot of friends outside of the work that I was doing. And that's when it really kind of, I became aware of a different kind of life I was leading. And yeah, there were definitely moments where I sort of questioned whether it was something that I wanted to be doing, and did I not want to go to college or a regular high school or have regular friends. It honestly was relatively fleeting. It wasn't something that I carried with me for a long time. It wasn't a great burden. But there were definitely moments.
Yeah, I bet.
I think getting through that relatively quickly to the other side of that thought process, which was, having perspective on what a unique life I got to lead and was leading, the opportunities that I got to have that I probably wouldn't have if I had not had that path, that then sort of superseded any kind of fear of missing out on the other aspects of life that I would have otherwise had.
I think that it does say something for your upbringing that you were able to appreciate what was happening to you, because I would think that, you know, day 15 on a shoot that isn't that easy and you're 12 and you have to show up and you have to be there at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
That kind of takes a special kid not to, like, sabotage that or try to... I mean, I'm sure there's a power shift or a dynamic that happens when a film crew needs to make their day. But did your mom make an effort to watch for that kind of shift?
Yeah, I felt like her primary modus operandi was drilling humility into me and not allowing any sense of privilege to be experienced unduly or exploited, you know?
Right.
So like, it manifested in some of the innocuous and significant ways. Like, at lunchtime, they often like to rush the actors through the lunch line so that they can be done eating before the crew is, so that they are ready for, like, after lunch checks and everything, and they can kind of keep moving with their day. And my mom would never let me do that. She would never let me skip the line. She's like, no, you stand in the line with the crew, and you also eat with the crew. And you know, simple things, but man, that makes a huge difference. She wouldn't let me, at the end of the day, if I wanted to, like, take off my wardrobe and just, like, throw it down, she wouldn't let me do that. I had to hang everything up on hangers and make it nice.
Wow.
She's like, you're not going to make them clean up your shit. You're going to clean it up first. All these subtle little things that I still employ to this day.
You know, that's fascinating.
And all of those things provide this foundation for which the notion of accepting some kind of privilege is a foreign idea, because it's... you're kind of already becoming self-sufficient. You're taking care of yourself. You're not expecting or accepting special treatment. And so that was instilled in me at such a young age that it's just kind of provided the foundation and the core of who I am. I couldn't behave any other way.
What do you think her biggest fear was when you started to find real success?
I have to think it comes down to losing me as a person. You know, getting swept up in the things that don't matter. Going down paths that would destroy me, potentially, or... You know, there's a lot of temptation within the context of the industry, certainly as you get older.
And there's examples of other kids your age who had a career going and made really bad decisions, right?
Yeah, and it ruined their lives. You know, life-changing decisions that ultimately sent them down really... tragic paths, and those were always made very apparent to me. I remember that too. Even when I was young, I remember the notion of learning from other people's mistakes so that I don't have to make them myself. I was very aware of that. But I would say if those were probably the things that she was the most afraid of.
Yeah.
Just losing me as a person, losing what she found to be the kind of the important fundamentals of what she was trying to instill in her kids.
And it sounds like she managed to do it in a way that you retained a friendship and a respect for her. It doesn't sound like
completely
like she was cracking the whip.
No,
that's really lucky.
Super lucky.
Yeah,
super lucky. I owe her everything. And I was surprisingly very aware of what she was doing when she was doing it. At least by the time I was 12 or 13. Because, you know, a child's relationship to a mother or father can be combative. It can have a lack of understanding. It just feels like they're reprimanding you, but you don't necessarily give a shit why.
And I would think when you're up there in the tree and you have to sing to this girl and your mom's there, that's embarrassing too, right?
Yeah, I had to make out with Christina Ricci on film in front of my mom too.
That must add, as a teenage boy, that must add a level of mortification. I did most of my making out not in the company of my mother.
No, same. It speaks to our relationship, too.
Yeah.
You know, that it kind of never got there for me. There's certainly kids, they don't really relate to their parents anymore. They don't really want to be around their parents. they're embarrassed by them. There are all these sort of classic cliches. And it just never happened for me. My mom was a great friend, too, and we spent so much time together.
When was the first extended film, like, on location where you went and lived on your own without, where she didn't come along?
I think it was for a James Toback film that not many people have seen called Black and White.
Where did that film?
It was shot in New York City, so, yeah, I lived in Manhattan for, I think it was about 6 to 8 weeks, something like that.
How old were you?
17.
So that must have been different, right?
It was super different, yeah. Kind of out on my own, living in New York. There was a sense of independence. It felt appropriate. It didn't feel like, shit, I'm on my own now. Like, how am I going to do this?
And at that point, could you walk around without being recognized?
At that point, yeah. I think there was some recognizability, but not. Lord of the Rings became its own thing.
Right.
And there were some young actors on the film, too, and so we all kind of hung out. I enjoyed it. It was cool to have a sort of New York experience for the first time as, you know, kind of an early adult.
Yeah. And then when you go off and make Lord of the Rings, you're gone for almost 2 years, right?
That
and
was
you're
another
living on
thing
your own.
Totally.
That feel more like it sounds like the New York thing sounds like a summer vacation almost.
It kind of was, yeah.
But then when you go do Lord of the Rings, that was like the real, like, you're just a dude out on your own at that point, right?
Totally. Yeah, Lord of the Rings was unprecedented on so many levels for me. You know, I'd never been away from home for that length of time. It was 16 months of principal photography for all three films, so I was living in New Zealand. I'd never been to New Zealand before. It was the furthest away I'd ever been from home. And with this great responsibility to embody this literary character.
Yeah. Were there any aspects of that was lonely or?
Initially, I often went through the same process whenever I would travel on location. The first 24 hours I would count on being lonely and feeling out of my element. That would manifest in, you know, sort of uncomfortable stomach and just, I don't know anybody. I'm not in my comfort zone. I don't know where I'm at. I'm in a hotel room. All of those things. And kind of incredibly, when I landed in New Zealand and got to the Wellington airport and was picked up by someone in production, I was then driven around Wellington to sort of get a little lay of the land of what the city was. It's a relatively small city, so it didn't take long. And I kind of instantly felt comfortable and at ease, and that had never happened to me.
Wow. You're still so young at that age, and you go off
to do that. I was 18, yeah.
18 years old. You know, I watched a clip of... I think your last line, I think you were doing pickups or reshoots, and it's sort of a behind-the-scenes thing, and Peter Jackson keeps on asking you to do it again, and why don't you try it this way, and why don't you try it that way, and it becomes apparent that he just doesn't want the experience to end.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And I remember that very well.
And it got me thinking about the family that you created with him and doing that for so long. I mean, that's a singular experience in movie making.
Totally.
To go for that long.
Yeah.
So I wonder how close you grew to your director on that and how that affected you.
I felt very close to Peter. I think all of us did. But not in such a way in where I felt like he would let us in on his personal anxieties.
Really? Or, it wasn't that.
Or his fatigue. He genuinely seemed infatigable until the very end, which is kind of remarkable. He was a great leader in that way. Sort of boundless energy, you know, up against so many challenges, and in the face of those challenges, a kind of, well, okay, like, this is what it is, and kind of, all right, well, we're going to do this now. Practical, pragmatic, but I think he also really believed in his team. I think he never lost sight of the small picture. It's really easy to look at the big picture and think, fuck, what am I doing? It's unwieldy, it's massive, there are all these moving parts and I'm at the helm of it all. And there are these people in Hollywood who are banking on this thing working.
Right.
There's all of that. But I think in the face of those concerns and anxieties, which could be crippling, he came to work every day and focused on this, on us and what he does best and what he loves most. And I think that kept the the larger sort of existential fears of how the whole thing could come crumbling down and kind of put it into the work. That's what I saw, you know.
Well, it's funny because you go for so long and make three films, it's probably easy to divorce yourself from the fact that anyone's ever going to see it.
Totally.
Right? I mean, did you feel that way in a way too?
Yeah, it's...
Like you just disappeared for a few years.
That's what it felt like. It felt very immersive and isolated from the rest of the world. It isolated from the industry, from Hollywood and other eyes. And we were kind of in our own world. We were in New Zealand making what really felt like the world's largest independent film. It didn't feel... The scale was massive, of course, but it felt like it was made with ingenuity and creativity. And, you know, the chain mail was made by, like, hand linked together by this guy at Weta Workshop who did them all. And there was a sword man making all of the swords. So everything felt like it was homegrown. And in that sense, it felt like we were all in it together, making something, crafting something from the ground up. And that felt tangible and real. And it didn't feel massive or above all of us. It felt like we were all contributors to that thing as well.
That indie spirit, yeah.
That was very much the vibe of making those films, and except on a much larger scale. It was, you know, 2,000 some odd people who were on the crew, and that extends to the digital department and so on and so forth, but about 2,000 people. But yet it never felt that big. It felt like, you know, we were still knocking on people's doors to ask them if they can use their land, because we ended up not being able to go to the top of this mountain because of the weather, so can we get some, you know, shots walking on your land, sir? Like, it was that stuff.
I imagine someone saying okay and then 600 people coming around the corner.
But that's what I remember, and I think that's what I remember about Peter specifically as well. He's that person, and I think one of the great qualities a director, I think, can have, if I were to pick a favorite quality or one that I, when I eventually direct, one I would want to embody, is the ability to listen and that anyone's idea is worth it, that there's everyone has the possibility to contribute, and it's worth listening to everybody. And Peter was very much that kind of director, just as willing to listen to, you know, the guy who just made him some tea about some shot or whatever it was, as he would be his DP or his actors. And that creates an atmosphere. And it does two things. It aligns yourself with the notion of hearing something that could potentially help you, which is always a good thing, I think, as a director.
Yeah.
But it creates a sense in your workforce and your crew of them being a part of it, being included, it being an all-inclusive creative experience. And that is very much what it felt like, and that extended from him.
God, it must have felt like such a personal, like you say, the idea that you work on it together for so long and only, you know, like you say, a couple thousand people know what's going on. And
yeah,
it must have been a shock when it goes out to the world, right?
Yeah, I think to a certain degree we felt that at Cannes. We went to Cannes that year that it came out, so May of that year. And we showed some footage from the film. It was the first time anyone had seen anything.
Right.
And there was a big party with sets from the film, or certainly, you know, versions of sets from the film, and ring wraiths, people on horseback riding through the party. The scale of that, the anticipation suddenly became massive. And the realization of, wow, this is all happening in a number of months. This first movie's going to come out. And, you know, this thing that we were tucked away in New Zealand making all this time is now going to be released into the world, and it could do something. It could be something significant. We had no way of knowing, of course, what it was going to be. But to a certain degree, you do anticipate, based just on simply that anticipation building. I remember the first trailer. I remember when they cut the first trailer and that came out. You're like, holy shit, this is real.
It's real.
It's real.
The combination of being on one film for so long and moving to New Zealand, it must have almost felt like you weren't an actor anymore, or in terms of people knowing about your life or what projects you're doing, right? You must have felt in some ways removed from the business, and then you see the trailer and you're like, oh my God, right?
All of the exterior elements.
I can't imagine going through 2 years of work on something that no one saw and then having that work change your life so profoundly.
It's crazy. It's wild. There were other elements too that I think were kind of far grander and weirder. Like, I remember on Sunset Boulevard, where they often will take up the side of a building for a poster. The Lord of the Rings poster for Fellowship was on the side of a building. I think the teaser poster was my hand holding the ring, my face. And I was able to sort of shift perspective and kind of put it in its place very quickly. Like, that's crazy.
You did change your commute to drive by it every day.
But objectively, I could go, okay, that's crazy.
Right.
This is now a machine that I'm a part of. Wow, fuck, I'm on the side of a building. But also compartmentalize it and kind of go, well, that's the movie, you know? We were on the side of a plane, too, and there was, like, a whole promotional thing where we, like, took photos in front of this Air New Zealand jet with, like, various characters from The Lord of the Rings on the side of the plane. It got silly, but also wild and hilarious and fun. And we were doing it together. I think that helped as well.
You were like the Beatles. You weren't solo artists.
Yeah, it kind of felt like that. We were a fellowship. We were a group of actors who'd spent a long time working together and have become very close. And this was all happening to all of us. And so that made it more palatable and understandable, I think, for everybody. That you kind of had each other to rely on. That this is wild. Like, holy shit, these things are happening. And this movie's going to be big. And wow, it's come out and it's fucking massive. And there are all these things that we could kind of share together.
Well, what I'm so curious about is watching your career post Lord of the Rings and the choices you've made. Mm. Did that film experience sort of solidify your philosophy towards picking roles?
After working on something that massive, I remember getting home and two things came to my mind. One, I don't want to work for a second because I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And two, when I do go to work on something, I want it to be really small. I just want to go work on something as an actor and have it be tiny. And some of that was in relation to being the direct opposite scale of what I'd just been on.
Right.
Not wanting to be in makeup for an hour and a half every day, not wanting those hours, not wanting the time commitment. But also, doing something immediately that was so different from what Lord of the Rings was going to be. And that was a distinct thing, too, that I knew that there were going to be 3 years of these Lord of the Rings films. And I wanted to keep working as an actor, regardless of whether it would be a problem or not. I didn't want to only be associated with that one role. And so, in my mind, I kind of started that process pretty early and just thought, well, as long as I continue to work on things as an actor in the interim that are really different and, you know, create sort of a new path for me, then the size of Lord of the Rings won't infringe upon the path it is that I want to take. So that I just remember having that distinct feeling. I don't know that I ever had a sense of, post Lord of the Rings, a path that people saw laid out for me. If anything, I think there was a perception that I was younger than I was.
Really?
Which was something that I definitely dealt with for a long time. Because I don't look my age. I didn't then, I don't really now.
Right.
So that I remember being a struggle. And
no, I had to buy you beer earlier today.
See?
Yeah.
I still get carded.
By the way, you didn't pay me back.
I'll Venmo.
Do you still get carded?
Sure.
Well, you will have the last laugh because you'll be 138 and people will think you're only 90.
Right, there you go.
Well, okay, so what I see in the choices you've made post Lord of the Rings is that it seems like you're not making choices based on a character being necessarily likable or bankable or a certain salary or a certain, you know, vehicle for you to win awards and get more mm-hmm. prestigious films. It seems like the choices you make are incredibly, I don't know if experimental is the right word, but it's certainly complex characters that allow you to stretch and allow you maybe a freedom from expectation of how a film should perform, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that wrong to say it? It seems
lovely,
like you haven't sought out how to top Lord of the Rings, and I think that a lot of people could fall into that trap.
Right. Yeah, it was never my intention to try and top Lord of the Rings because I knew inherently that it was untoppable. You know, there was no way I was going to have that experience again.
Or that now you're going to be this movie star, right, and you're going to transition your experience from Lord of the Rings
and expound on that into something much larger.
Yes, and then you're going to find the vehicle to make you the guy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because that would probably be a fairly natural thought for an actor.
It totally would. Yeah.
And so what makes you different
that
way?
And I think had I been more strategic or strategically minded, I probably would have tried that path. I think...
It's funny you say that, and I don't believe it. I believe that you're a guy who accidentally became one of the biggest movie stars in the world, but you love really interesting work, and...
That's exactly what it is at its core.
Yeah.
I just love to work, and I love... And this has become clearer and clearer to me. I just want to work with great filmmakers. I like to work with my friends. And I want to work on things that, as a whole, I find interesting. And I think the older I got, the more clear that became. The more people I met, the more people I found I was had a shared vision, like-minded in regards to the kind of films that I love. And, you know, I started going to this film festival in Austin, Texas, about 6 or 7 years ago, called Fantastic Fest. And it's a genre film festival. It's probably my favorite week of the year. And at that place, at that festival, there's a sense of community within this sort of genre filmmaking community, which is pretty wide, and it's international. Yeah, horror.
Dark thrillers.
Exactly. Asian action films. Things that are slightly left of center. And at this particular film festival, I made so many incredible friends with filmmakers. Ultimately, Grand Piano and a movie called Open Windows, directed by a guy called Nacho Vigalondo. Both of those came out of relationships from Fantastic Fest.
Oh, really?
So there's something there, too. There's something about just being open and sharing love of cinema with people, and that has just become clearer as I've gotten older. And
well, the choices you've made lately, I mean, Wilfred was weird and surreal, and
yeah.
And you know, you're doing Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Which... I don't think I'm smart enough to completely understand. And
you'll get it at the end.
I'm so, you know, you just did this film, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore.
Yeah.
Which, you know, all these things could be called genre in a way.
Mm.
But the choices you're making, it's notable how off-center they are. It's not a little off-center.
Right.
They're very off-center, weird choices that require like... You can't read a description of any of the three projects I just mentioned mm-hmm. and go, date night.
Right. They're not conventional.
They're not conventional
stories.
What I wanted to say about I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore mm-hmm. is that it has something in common with a film like Falling Down or Network. It starts with a person who's trying to follow all of society's rules and realizes, well, no one else is following these rules.
Yeah, everyone's assholes.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
Totally, yeah.
But it seems like a genre film has rules that make it a genre film in a lot of ways. And
sure.
It seems like the films you're making take unexpected turns. When you're 10 minutes into this film, you don't know if it's going to be a romantic comedy or a little indie darling.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if... you can see a through line of these projects that you pick.
I do. I think I do see a connection. I think that they're all unique. They're not the normal stories. They're not straight up and down dramas or straight up and down comedies. I think I'm attracted to that both as an actor, producer, creator, as much as I am as a person. Those are the films that I tend to be drawn to as a viewer. But it's also, you know, in the case of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, that film was written by a guy called Macon Blair.
Who wrote
Green Room, and I'd never seen Macon act or never heard of him before, and I was blown away by him, and then was so anticipating Green Room, because I love Jeremy Saulnier as a director, and saw Green Room, was blown away, and I met Macon at Fantastic Fest, and he was like, hey, can I share a script with you? And I was thrilled. Like, I guess the reason I bring him up and that scenario up is I was thrilled to get a script from this guy who I really admire, who I think is an incredible filmmaker in his own right. And something that he'd written and that he'd want to share with me was a truly exciting thing. And I read the script And it was incredible. And it was this thing that sort of starts out being this kind of slightly funny, maybe morose dramedy into something a little bit screwball because it's like the hijinks of these two people like on a caper together to try and get
and
her stolen goods.
Through it and, yeah.
And then it turns into something super fucking gnarly at the end of the movie. And it really takes a massive turn as they get kind of way in over their heads. And I'd never read anything like it.
Right.
And I thought, how fun would it be to start my year off working with this guy? I have so much faith in him as an actor and as a writer. I know he's going to make an incredible film. So, yeah, I do recognize, I think, that there is a through line. I think I'm not really, if I'm honest, I don't think I'm attracted to standard dramas or standard comedies. I think I'm...
Well, that's clear.
I think it's clear. I'm attracted to things that have a slight twist on them and are slightly left of center and are unlike things we've seen before. I have a production company as well called SpectreVision, and that's very much the modus operandi of our company as well. We're looking to make movies that in some cases would never be made. We produced a movie last year called The Greasy Strangler that premiered at last year's Sundance, and it's truly bizarre and not sort of, you can't really categorize the film, and it's very funny, it's super disturbing, there's a lot of weird body humor, it's fucked up. And that movie kind of maybe wouldn't have been made if a group of maniacs hadn't gotten together and said, let's fucking get this thing made. And I love that spirit, and I'm attracted to that both as a filmmaker, producer, and as an actor as well. I just want to be a part of facilitating things that I think are interesting and should be in the world, I guess.
Well, it seems like you're also a proud card-carrying member of wanted to be with the pack of maniacs rather than being in with the pack of mainstream Hollywood. And
yeah, sure.
I hear you saying you want to make art, you don't want to make money.
Yeah. Like,
circling all back around to the way you started out. I wonder if you think that gave you maybe a different perspective on what success really is.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's never been greatly financially motivated for me. It has insofar as I have to make a living. But beyond that, it's always been about artistic integrity, you know, trying to make the choices that are true to who I am and what I'm interested in doing rather than being transactional or looking for a paycheck. And to me, that would be greatly disingenuous. If the path was sort of carved out with only sort of financial interests, it'd be disingenuous to the process and go against everything I believe. So it'd be really difficult for me to have carved that path out. And I think all of that was established when I was young. It's all a collection of what I've experienced from being 8 years old in this industry until now, I suppose.
Well, it's notable that you could do such big films and then find yourself on such a creative exploration and live that life. It's impressive, and I think that
thank you.
Because of that, you're always going to be able to surprise yourself and you're going to always do interesting work. So it's been really fun watching your career.
Oh, thanks, Sam.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful, man. I mean, that's what I think every artist is looking for. If they're invested in the thing that they're doing, and I'm sure you feel the same way, just getting to a place where you can fully express that in the way that you want to and have the freedom to do that, that's everything. Because I don't think about it in a very self-aware way. I'm not making these choices so that people can look at the weird choices I'm making.
Sure.
But it's always interesting and quite flattering when people do sort of point it out and they go, I see what you're doing. You're kind of just doing your thing. And that's a good feeling. That's because that's exactly what it is I'm trying to do.
Well, I think that it's a good example for anyone that got into this because they're just creative at their core,
mm-hmm.
to not forget that and to not, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times creativity comes with a giant gaping psychological hole to fill.
Totally.
And that takes over.
Sure.
But I think that you've managed to keep that at bay and you know, you carved out something really interesting. So
thanks, dude.
Thanks for telling me all about it.
Yeah, man. This has been super fun.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. And just a point of trivia here. When my wife and I got married, we honeymooned in New Zealand, and I ended up getting horribly sick and ended up in all of these little hotels and bed and breakfasts around New Zealand, and the only DVDs in every one of those rooms were the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think I watched those movies 6 or 7 times, and it was really fun for me to get to sit down with Elijah Wood, so I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Hey, send me an email if you have any guest suggestions, ideas for the show, comments, criticisms, or if you just want to say hi. I'm Sam at offcamera.com. Also, please take a minute, go to offcamera.com, check us out. We have a store there. We have an exclusive magazine that we make for every guest that comes on the show. We also have an app and lots of different ways to get involved with the show. You can check us out on social media. We are Off Camera Show at both Instagram and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. Also, if you haven't yet, go give us a rating on iTunes. Anything above 4 stars is totally acceptable. And if you're listening to this now, and by chance you don't know we're also a television show, you can find us on Audience Network, on DirecTV, Channel 239, or on Netflix. So check all that out, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor and producer David Oyelowo.
I deem this thing celestial. I do think there is something spiritual about how you can touch someone who you will never meet doing a film in a place they will never go with a narrative that they know nothing about, and yet it impacts the way they see their community, their family, their life, and their perception of those who look nothing like them.
David was enjoying a pretty nice career in the UK. So I had to ask what made him uproot his young family for an ill-timed and risky move to the United States. If you've seen his work in films like Selma, The Butler, Queen of Katwe, and A United Kingdom, you know it paid off. But as you'll hear, it wasn't easy. He shares why he finds both joy and great responsibility in his work. As an actor and a human, he's as inspiring as the stories he brings to the screen. So I'll see you next time, off camera.